Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh, sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Rabia Nusrat. Rabia is a British Pakistani and is currently Emerging Projects Manager for International Alert. Her areas of expertise are working with the business sector for peace building, conducting conflict analysis, development and management of peace building projects, donor policymaker liaison, and qualitative and quantitative research. As Emerging Projects Manager for South Asia, Rabia leads on consolidation and growth of Alert's new country programs, particularly Afghanistan, and provides day-to-day managerial support to the implementation of peace-building projects in Sri Lanka. Previously, Rabia has been Senior Program Officer, where she developed and implemented an effective country program for Pakistan. She was also Portfolio Manager for the British Asian Trust, where she established and managed the Trust's portfolio across the South Asian countries of Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka to ensure the effectiveness of all funded initiatives. Whilst in that role, Rabia spearheaded the introduction and implementation of an international mental health program in Pakistan and designed and managed the Pakistan Flood Recovery Fund, an initiative convened by the Prince of Wales. Rabia's education and training include a PG certificate in project appraisal and impact assessment, PG certificate in grant making, social investment and philanthropy, an MSc in international policy analysis, a BSc honours in economics and management, training in strategy and business planning, urban crime and violence prevention, and skills building programme on conflict prevention for the EU. Rabia is fluent in Urdu and English. Good grief, Rabia. I'm feeling hugely inadequate in my life after reading that.
Yeah. I'm always terrified when people use words like expert and things like that. It's always slightly scary because it puts so much pressure on you.
Well, I have to say, and bless you for being interviewed and taking time out of your busy life. I know you're studying for something else, and you have a paper that you need to get in a couple of days' time. So, bless you for taking the time out. I mean, when I was reading that, I mean, it sounds hugely impressive because it is hugely impressive, but it really doesn't encapsulate what you actually do. So, tell us, what do you actually do?
Well, I mean, I've been with International Alert for over four years now.
Right.
And it has been, there is never a dull and a boring day in my life.
No, I can imagine.
And it has been an incredibly steep learning curve. But involved both developing myself professionally, but also a lot of personal learning.
Right.
When I started with Alert 4 years ago, Alert had gotten a grant to do some work in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So that's where the journey began from.
Right.
It was quite exciting I don't come from a peace building background. Mm-hmm. I come from a development sector background. So that itself was a challenge for me. But to create something which did not exist was, I think, the most motivating thing for me, and that's why the job attracted me quite a bit, other than the fact that it was my own country that I would get to work for. So when we started off with Alert Pakistan program, it was interesting, exciting because A, it meant the day-to-day management or trying to implement the project that we had gotten, mm-hmm. but also to develop the country program, and that means building relationships, setting up a team, forming partnerships, looking out for new ideas, materializing those ideas. Mm. So that's what I did then, and that's what I do now more in Afghanistan. in Sri Lanka is also very interesting, because I think after the change of the government in Sri Lanka, the space suddenly opened up to do more work for peace building organizations. And we had done, we've been in Sri Lanka for about 30 years. So now this was the time we felt that, can we take our work to a new level? So that's why in itself, that was another sort of existing opportunity. And the country, both countries that I work on are totally different politically, culturally, trying to deal. So it's also very interesting, because one day you are working, or within the day you're working on Afghanistan, trying to deal with people and partners in Afghanistan, but the other the next hour you would have to work in, you would have to talk to people in Sri Lanka, and that means sort of go into the Sri Lankan culture and try, you know, so place yourself there. So I think that all is what I try and do, but that's what all makes it more exciting.
I mean, it's amazing when you say work. I mean, I can the change in culture is incredible, but when you're saying you're working with people in these countries, you're not working from the UK, are you? You actually go to the countries. So as
actually both, and that's what's right. Also interesting and has been a great learning experience in its own way. So yes, I travel a lot more to Afghanistan to sort of work with partners, but and similarly I've go to Sri Lanka to work with the Sri Lankan team, but they're but a lot of my work involves remotely communicating and managing.
Right.
Which has, again, as I said, that has probably been the biggest personal learning experience. Because you're behind a computer, or you're on a telephone receiver when you're talking to people. So how to be very, very patient, not jump to conclusion, trying to understand what is going on in their world, and keeping all of that in mind when you're a forming any kind of decisions or any conclusions in your head, but also being mindful and insightful that you should also not be taken for granted.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an interesting balance to try and strike, isn't it? And particularly as we know, communication, 97% of it is nonverbal.
Yeah.
And a big proportion of that is the body language and the facial expression and the eye contact. So when you're talking to somebody on the phone, a huge part of how we communicate and how we receive messages is removed. So you add that in to the cultural mix. it's a tricky business.
Yeah. I think email is even more dangerous.
Absolutely, it is, because you lose the voice as well.
Yes, so it's on your own interpretation. So
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Is this what the person means? Is this what the person's saying?
It's a tricky business. I mean, I always say that when I'm working with people training, you know, email and text messages are so potentially dangerous, because you're only working with 7% of how people receive messages. So you have to be so careful, because you are not in control of how somebody is going to interpret your message.
Yes, and that exactly is, I guess, so this is particularly interesting for this field of work, peace building, because that's what you're trying to encourage people externally to do. So you have to apply it very much internally also when you're dealing with yourself, but with your colleagues and with the organization. The same principles have to be applied internally.
Well, yeah, absolutely, yes, indeed. About with everybody we communicate with. So what is exactly are you wanting to achieve? What are the long-term goals of the organization and of you?
That's a very, very broad question.
It is a broad question. Okay, we're international alert. What are the goals and the aims, the, if you like, the wish list of international alert? What does it want to achieve? What legacy does it want to leave?
I think alert's strapline is quite interesting that way. Understanding conflict and building peace.
Right.
So I think the overall goal is that there's this very clear understanding that, you know, people always will be in conflict with each other. That's what people do.
Yeah, sadly.
They're going to be people. But what we want to try and encourage people to do is to manage those conflicts non-violently.
I see. Okay.
So that's I think probably the key point.
Right.
to understand. But then the sort of the other goals or aspirations, as if you would call it that way, is to be able to, for me particularly, with for the organization, is to put people and their voices back into the conversation.
Right.
It's all about the local people, the local context, you know, what experiences are they going through, what psychosocial dynamics do they have to deal with. Mm. And in this external and extremely connected, interconnected world, how do you encourage them, facilitate them, support them to be able to deal with conflicts and conflict and drivers of conflict that exist at the very local level.
Right.
Then I think the next step that we take is, how do you connect those very local voices to first the national level, mm-hmm. but then secondly, how do you try and influence policymakers or make these voices heard at the policy levels, and you know.
Mm.
So, and the ALERT takes on the way sort of we approach peace building is we work through certain thematic areas. So, in the part of the world that I sort of work most on, we have been working a lot on using the private sector or the business sector as an entry point to peace building.
I see.
Where our sort of understanding is that, you know, private, local, particularly local businesses, they have a very key interest in maintaining peace and stability in the areas where they are working, because A, it affects them directly, mm-hmm. But they're also positioning, puts them in an interesting place, having and as a part of interesting networks to be able to influence peace building at that level. Mm. So that's one sort of thematic area that I've been doing a lot of work on in particularly Pakistan and now Afghanistan, and in somewhere that was sort of also a key part of ALERT's work in Sri Lanka. Then the second thematic area that I've been doing a lot more work on is looking at gender and its relation to peace building.
Oh, interesting.
But I think the way we understand gender is not women and girls. It's a much broader topic than that.
Yeah.
And what ALERT uses is what we call a gender relational approach, which includes both men and women, but mm-hmm. also girls and boys. And mm-hmm. it sort of tries to first understand the gendered identities that are formed at every level, on the basis of class, age, caste, education background, status in society, and trying to understand that, and then see how, what sort of points of influence could be that you can work with in order to improve situations, not just for girls and women, but also to understand what kind of implications notions of masculinities have on men and boys.
It's so important, isn't it, to look at the rounded picture.
So those are, I guess, the two more sort of broader areas. And then I've done some other work, and ALERT's also interested, for example, looking at state-citizen relationship and how do you strengthen that and how that's key to peace and stability within any country. Then also looking at, for example, justice and security sector.
Right.
And, you know, how do you connect... Again, I mean, it was also very interesting because when I first went to Afghanistan, I was like, oh, yeah, the informal justice sector. And they were like, no, it's not informal just because you're coming from Western country. It doesn't mean you can label our very traditional structures informal. So that was another learning experience.
How do you cope with the people who have a lot invested in keeping the conflicts alive and well?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, again, that was very interesting for me when I started working in ALERT, that, you know, you the understanding within the organization and also the attempt that you can't ignore the spoilers or the people who have a vested interest in keeping the war alive. How do you, have to try and engage them.
Mm.
It may be difficult, it may take a very, very long time, and you may need to take indirect approaches to include them, but you cannot ignore that.
Mm.
And that's what's challenging, but that's what I think it's also very it's very, very important to strive towards, because otherwise you, whatever you're going to come up with is going to be a half-cooked kind of solution.
Yeah. How do you also manage the expectations of the citizens that you work with? Because they must see you arriving in International Alert as a beacon of light and hope. And it would be part of human nature to have newly raised expectations that actually everything is going to be okay. How do you manage that and balance their expectations and balance what can be achieved in a realistic timescale?
I think the expectations are sort of, you can put them just separately, you can put them in two boxes actually. Mm-hmm. One is because, see, this part of the world, particularly Pakistan, Afghanistan, have had so much development aid going into it, and all that aid has gone into building things, very tangible things, that's also what the expectation is, that these people will come and they will do something which, A, they're going to give us something.
Yeah.
And they're going to build something, you know, so something very tangible has to be there. Well, our work is non-tangible most of the time.
Right.
How do you see building relationships?
Yeah.
You know? So it's managing those expectations,
yeah.
That this is what we are going to do, but this is what our intervention would be geared towards, which can be disappointing for some people, because unfortunately what this aid, so much of influx of aid into these countries has done is it has created the sense of dependency and always wanting something, but also the sense of victimhood, that, you know, the savior is going to come from outside. So you know, that is the other bit of expectation management, that you, how do you encourage people to take ownership of their work, whatever they're going to do, they're going to do it themselves. We are just facilitators or convener. Our role is just as humble as that. It's nothing more than that. But I think to manage all of this, it's all about communication and all about building trust with people, which is as simple as talking to them, but more important than talking, listening to them, and trying to understand what they're actually saying, and then all of this is a long-term process, and that's, I think, sometimes which gets forgotten in the midst of this, you know, donor-funded timelines and project timelines. But when you're dealing with humans, when you it takes time to build relationships, that is with us, but also between people within communities. This is a process, it takes time.
It does take time. And it's something that popped into my head then, which is something that I've questioned internally with myself, but have never voiced externally. Is that I see, and we all witness a lot of donor contributions to these countries, whether be it food or money or particularly resources, stuff that they need. And I often ask myself, why are we doing it? It smacks a bit. And this is probably going to be a very controversial statement of the arrogance of the West, that if we throw enough at these poor, in inverted commas, poor countries that are not as good as us, in inverted commas, it kind of assages our guilt that we have quite an easy life in comparison to a lot of people on this planet right now. And if we just throw money and stuff at them, then we can think we've done our bit and we don't have to worry anymore. But what we don't do is think through the consequences of that, that we are, in fact, creating people and countries that, as you rightly say, end up with a victim mentality and become dependent, which actually isn't a healthy place, because you kind of create this codependency. We need them to make us feel good, and they need us for food, medical supplies, money, whatever. And actually, is that a healthy dynamic? And is what International Alert is doing the much better way? It's longer and therefore potentially frustrating for you and for the countries. But actually, looking from a moral standpoint, is it the better way to go? How dangerous is what the West is doing by just throwing stuff at these countries and thinking that's okay? How dangerous is that strategy?
I think I would sort of look at it from at again two levels. One is, yes, I think I do see the merit of giving this help,
right,
but I would question the way it is given and how the way it is given. So, for example, you cannot have externally constructed models, ready-made models or solutions implemented in these countries. And I think that's where what makes it dangerous, as you said.
Right.
So, for example, something that has worked in UK will not work in a village in Pakistan.
I mean, sure.
That's
probably
very obvious. But the second thing is that also within Pakistan, something just because has worked in an urban area or in Karachi, Lahore, doesn't mean it'll work in another part of the country.
Right.
So, you know, all those complexities and contextual details need to be understood. And that also goes, and then also thinking that, oh, this is a Muslim country, so a solution that has worked in another Muslim country will work here.
Yeah.
This is a South Asian country, a solution that has worked in another South Asian country will work here. So that is what I think makes it dangerous, because that sometimes in my, from very limited experience and in my humble opinion, sometimes damages the fabric of the societies. And also the other dangerous urgency for me is this, you know, sometimes you should not be encouraging or go or the outcomes you are looking for should not be jumping from A to Z. You know, sometimes going from A to B is probably what is the most important thing.
Yeah.
And that's what you should be doing and sort of facilitating people to do. But then the second level I would look at is, yes, I mean, it is very, very important to not create this dependency and victimhood, but to try and build skills and capacities. So, you know, we all talk about, I mean, whichever project proposal we write, we have to write a section on sustainability.
Yeah.
So, you know, we all come up with things to write in that. But if you actually think deeply enough, what would make something sustainable, you know? And that's where I think the real sort of ingredients is probably hidden, if you can call it that way. That it's building local ownerships, local capacities, and unless and until that is done, that confidence is built in people, those horizontal and vertical linkages are built, nothing that you are going to build is going to last very long.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable that the work that you do. You must come up against people in the countries who try to stop you.
Yeah.
How do you get around that? How do you cope with that?
So I think if we take the example of Sri Lanka has been a very constricted operating environment for INGOs and particularly those working in peace building. But then I think Alert was quite successful in not being asked to leave the country any time. And we've been in Sri Lanka for 30 years now.
Wow.
Again, I think that's also about understanding context, understanding people, understanding the power dynamics within the society, and something that we call use the term a bit too often, but when you sort of sit back and think, yes, that is so important, is thinking about conflict sensitivity as an approach. So the work that you do, how do you keep in mind that you're not endangering anyone who gets involved with you? That includes your staff members and the beneficiaries that you're sort of working with, but also how do you try and take on board the difficult elements within the society or within the context that you're working on. How do you manage and tread very carefully? Because it's because, you know, getting sometimes having a presence and doing little amount of work is probably far more important than doing something so drastically controversial that you get thrown out. You know, that is not that is not also going to sort out the problem in in my opinion. So how do you find a middle ground to work on? It may mean it sometimes also, you know, get you also sometimes get questioned quite a lot and labeled, oh, what are these people doing? This is not relevant. But if you sit back and reflect, then, you know, those that even that minute and very small intervention, it may seem at that point, keeps the window open. And that's I think, very important in the long run.
That what popped into my head then as you were talking was, I think, an old Chinese proverb. A journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. And it is those small steps that gradually build. And you know, I can remember my dad. I mean, this is kind of irrelevant, but kind of relevant. When I was younger, I can remember my dad saying to me about relationships. And he was saying, relationships that come to the boil really, really quickly will lose steam just as quickly. But the ones that simmer away on the back burner and take longer are the ones that will last. And I thought, okay. And I, you know, when I was a teenager, I thought, yeah, right, you know, you old fogey, you don't know what you're talking about. But actually, he was absolutely right. And you can take that to any kind of relationship. You know, whether it's a personal relationship, a business relationship, the relationships that you're building, it's that slow, steady approach where you are gradually building momentum. That's where you create sustainability, isn't it, and longevity.
Yes, I mean, I couldn't agree more. But that, you know, but then the frustration is that, you know, how do you put that relationship or capture that relationship in a log frame? in an indicator, you know. But you know, so that's a bit. It sometimes gets frustrating.
It must do.
But you know, if you sort of look at a lot of work that is done within sort of the development sphere, and you know, so a training or a workshop has happened. Now that is getting people together in a room from 9 to 5 for even 2 to 3 days. It's not going to bring any kind of attitudinal change in them. Very highly unlikely. And B, it's not going to form any kind of relationships. People come to these events or these workshops for all kinds of different reasons. Unless and until you're going to give it its due time, A, nothing in their minds will change, and B, no relationships with you or with internally, you know. Sometimes I think even if you look at if you look at sort of the at our own personal lives, you know, sometimes relationships also have to go through that process of initial fighting, suspicion, you know, within siblings to be able to have a bond that lasts a long a lifetime. So, you know, but that all takes needs time and space.
It does. I mean, when I'm working with groups and teams, I call it the four stages. So it's forming, storming, norming and performing. So, you know, you form a group and then you have the storming phase where everybody is jostling for position, and then it normalizes and then you start performing. And it doesn't matter where that group is. Actually, those rules absolutely apply.
No, I couldn't agree more. What's you have to go through, we're human beings.
Absolutely. And we all have egos, which, you know, have to play out on varying scales and complexities. And
and emotions need to be allowed to come out. Only then you will be able to move past them.
Oh, well, absolutely. Because if things are kept in and they're churning away inside, that's when they start to get blown out of all proportion and actually cause problems.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it's bringing it out onto the table and discussing it. It's key. It's discussing something when it's the size of an acorn and not waiting until it's grown into the oak tree, because then it becomes a lot more difficult to handle.
Yeah.
What has been some of your most satisfying achievements, if achievements is the right word to use, while you've been with International Alert?
I think I wouldn't call them anything as an achievement as yet. I think I have a long way to go to achieve. But I think what is always encouraging for me is I mean, when I started working on Afghanistan and Sri Lanka, I basically wanted to take myself out of the comfort zone also. That, you know, how will Pakistan, I'm from Pakistan, born and lived in Pakistan all my life. So, you know, it was a familiar context. I at least somehow understood people, culture. Mm. So it was easier to navigate.
Mm.
And what I particularly wanted to test myself out was that, you know, how can I build relationships in Sri Lanka and Afghanistan in new contexts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was also an interesting experience for me coming here in the UK 7 years ago, because, you know, I packed my bags and came here with no job and no nothing, you know, so and with that sort of colonial mindset, everyone sitting in these big buildings would know everything, you know, and what can I do? I mean, I'm just an average, ordinary person from Pakistan. So I think that has been that is probably what keeps me going, is the relationships and friendships that I've been able to build both in Sri Lanka and in Afghanistan with mm-hmm. people. You know, that is probably what has been the most interesting thing for me in these two countries.
When we were chatting a couple of days ago before the interview, while we were setting the interview up, something that you said really struck me. Well, two things that you said, actually. The first thing that you said that really struck me was the last time you were in Afghanistan, in Kabul.
Yeah.
And you were staying in a guest house.
Yes.
And you were saying, you know, if something happened to me and I died, it would be a couple of days before people in London would find out. I mean, that sent shivers through my body, thinking, oh my God, is this woman insane? Why is she doing this to herself? And the other thing that struck me, possibly even more, was at the end when we were arranging when we were going to do this interview, that you said, I don't think I'm very inspiring or have much to say. I thought, what? So, I mean, really, you know, when I hear about some of the things that you do and the places that you go as a woman and as a single woman, and as you were rightly saying, as a Muslim Pakistani woman in Afghanistan, I mean, talk about ticking all the boxes of potential conflict. I mean, that's ticking them all, Rabia. So...
But see, Katie, I mean, for example, I guess, for example, you know, Pakistan, things have, in the sense that, you know, bomb blasts happening every day in Pakistan anymore. Thank God for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, when it was interesting because when I came here and I had to take a few better sort of colleagues back with me to Pakistan for various work purposes,
mm-hmm.
it was interesting because, you know, to think about things from their perspective.
Right.
That, you know, what would they imagine Pakistan to be?
Yes.
But, you know, I, having lived in Pakistan, growing up in Pakistan, yes, I mean, there were times a bomb blast would happen in the city. Half an hour later, you go to work. You know, life moves on.
Sure.
That's what I also now, talking to people, particularly in Afghanistan, you know, I see now myself in the position of that British colleague that I was taking and those people in my position. So, you know, I was talking to someone, and on that day the attack on the Kabul parliament was going on, and they were a few I don't know, kilometers away from that building. Mm. But they were like, yes, but, you know, life goes on. You know, everyone does not have a choice to go and out and leave the country. Mm. That's where their life is, and they have to make the most of it, you know. Mm. So then you sort of sit back and think, okay, so what is so special about me, you know? These people are living here. They have to go through this. So how, you know, I'm no way better than these people. There's no distinction between them and me. So, you know, it's sort of sometimes then you sort of get this, then you're able to work a little more sort of, I guess, then in all these fears and all of these concerns, mm. you're able to put on a back burner that, you know, this is reality, and this is reality for these people. So it's also a reality for me.
Sure.
And then I think the other thing is, I guess I also have a lot of faith in God, and that keeps me going, that if he's taken me somewhere, he would have some kind of a plan for me.
And hopefully part of that plan is to bring you back again as well.
Yes,
I mean, I think faith is hugely important for everybody, whatever that faith is. And I, you know, from my perspective, I don't think it matters what the faith is. Whether it's a religious faith or a universal faith or a faith in humanity, I don't care what somebody's faith is. But having some kind of belief system is hugely beneficial to people. I think it gives people a sense of connection and that and strength and courage to go forward, even though on a physical level you may be alone. But on an ethereal level, you have the you have the belief that you're not alone. And it was interesting. I was giving a talk a couple of years ago now to a group of people from the Middle East, and they were over in London on a leadership program. And I had some, you know, quite senior men and women, and it was one of the men who said to me, in the Middle East, we don't have much confidence. We feel inferior to the people who lead us, and we feel inferior to the people outside of the Middle East. And I thought, what an interesting insight. You know, that had never occurred to me before. You know, why would it really? And my answer to that was, which kind of took them a bit by surprise, bearing in mind this was a business meeting in front of leaders. And I said, well, actually, everybody, if you take our human body away on a soul level, we are all equal. So somebody on the streets of London who is homeless, who is begging for money and to have food, on a soul level, on a spiritual level, is equal to the Queen. Because our external shell is actually completely irrelevant. On a spiritual and soul level, everybody on the entire planet is equal. You know, what happens to be encasing that spirit in this lifetime while we're here right now is fate, is luck or not luck or whatever you want to call it, but it actually doesn't determine who we are. What actually determines who we are is our spirit and our core values, and on that level we are all equal. So if we take that, actually, that kind of helps. For me, it helps me to relate and communicate and build relationships with people who are very, very different to me, because actually, on a soul level, they're not.
Yes. No, I totally sort of agree with you, because, you know, sometimes when you're in the field, I sometimes think, okay, so what if I was not born where I was born, but I was born here, you know?
Yeah.
What would my life be? But also that thing was not in my control, so, you know, why should I gloat on that, you know? It's not, it just happened by luck and by fate. It could have happened the other way, so there is absolutely no difference between me and any other person.
And it's you know, if we could get that message across to people in conflict, whatever that conflict is, because a lot of conflict comes from a feeling, this is my perception, I'm not saying it's true, this is just my perception, that a lot of conflict is based in hierarchy. It's based in somebody thinking they are better than somebody else. And it's also based around territory, which is another complete fantasy of human beings that we think we own anything. We don't. We don't own our homes. Most people, where they live is either owned by a landlord or the bank. You know, we don't actually own it. Very few people actually own their own homes. And even when they do, they don't actually own it, because when they die, that building will carry on standing probably. You know, we have temporary custody of stuff, but we don't actually own anything, whether it's our car, our clothes, our home, our village, our town, our community, our country. We don't own anything, but as human beings, we go through life with a huge expectation of owning things and having the right over certain territories, which is part of conflict. How do we get through that?
Oh, I think that's probably the question that the answer to that.
Yeah.
It has a lot to do with try and create empathy within people.
Right.
That, you know, and I don't know what the proper dictionary meaning for empathy is, or how would intellectuals define it. Mm. But for me, and it was interesting because I was discussing sympathy versus empathy with someone a while back. Mm. And what I was trying to say was that, you know, when you are feeling sympathetic towards someone, in my understanding, you have created a slight hierarchy. Mm-hmm. That you are in a better position than that person. That's why you're feeling sympathetic towards that person. Mm-hmm. But empathy for me is slightly at an equal level, that mm-hmm. I try and understand and feel what that other person is going through. Mm-hmm. And that then for me at least is helpful to understand where the other person is coming from. Mm-hmm. And in that light, see the actions or the things that they're saying and doing. And that at least for me takes a lot of conflict in inverted comma away from that mm-hmm. relationship or from that engagement. Because, you know, then you're not automatically you're not jumping to conclusions or judgments mm-hmm. about their actions and what they're saying or anything that they're saying. Mm-hmm. But you're putting that in a context and understanding why they're saying things. So, you know, you're not being reactive to it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that makes sense.
Oh no, it makes a lot of sense. Yes, yeah.
So trying to create that empathy within people, I think, is what is needed. And from a very sort of, you know, when you and that starts from when you're at home, a toddler, at a very as a child, at your infant sort of years, and I think that's where parenting skills, but also, you know, the kind of home environment and school environment that you provided, that all goes into developing those kinds of feelings or consciousness amongst people. Mm.
It's stepping into somebody else's shoes, isn't it? And seeing, and we can't see life from their worldview, but at least we can try try to see the world from their perspective, not just our perspective.
And because a couple of years back told me some personal incident about their life, and I kept thinking about it, but why would they do this? I mean, how can they do this? But then I came to at least a realization myself that I am unable to do that because my thinking parameters don't allow me to do that, because I haven't experienced their life, they were in situations. So, you know, I can't really say I can't really understand or feel why they did something or how they did something, because it's just beyond my mental parameters, thinking parameters, you know. So I need to broaden it more and more as I go along in life to understand or bring in other people's perspective and feel their perspective.
Yeah. Amazing. So the future for you, where are you going, Rabia, in life?
Well, as I say to people, my travel plans are quite erratic. I don't know. I think I would want to continue working in this field. There are probably a few personal goals that I would want to achieve. One of them is, I also sometimes feel that I don't have an expertise in anything. So I've been thinking, should I do a doctorate so at least on the outside I can claim to have an expertise.
I'm so glad you're laughing while you say that. No expertise in anything. I think you've got more expertise than everybody I know combined.
How do I put a label?
Do you need to put a label on it, though? Do you need to?
Maybe I should do a PhD.
Okay.
But I think, I guess I'm not really sure where life would take me, because it has been quite an, as I think you also saw from my CV, it has been quite a chaotic kind of a journey, moving from here to there. But I guess wherever I want to be, I want to have the sense of being alive, you know, that I'm doing something.
Yeah.
I think that's probably where I would want to see myself at all stages of life. So I don't know where I will be, but this is what I want to be doing, is to be doing something with my life that keeps me alive, that makes me a more empathetic and a conscious person, I guess.
I mean, that is amazing, that feeling of being alive, of living, of filling our time, expanding into our time on this planet, fully expanding into it and experiencing living.
Yeah.
You know, there's an awful lot of people who go through life and don't really experience living.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's hugely important, isn't it? Because life is an incredible gift.
Yes.
And to expand into it and to do it to the best of our ability.
Yeah.
Is an incredible experience. And I gave a talk a few years ago to a women in business group where I stood up and said, hi, my name's Katie and I'm a control freak. At least I used to be until something happened and I let go of being a control freak. And when I let go of being a control freak, I mean, I understood why I was doing it and healed why I was doing it. But the moment I let go of having to control everything and I allowed my life to open up and unfold organically and randomly, it became far fuller. So it is about allowing ourselves to fully unfold our wings, isn't it? And to fly high wherever, and to be guided to a lot of things, is not trying to control it, but to, I think a lovely phrase from a friend, gosh, probably about 20 years ago, and that's always stuck with me. She said, let go, let God. And that was a really powerful statement. So don't try and control it. You know, take positive action and then let go of the outcome.
Yeah. And then experience everything. And I think from your negative emotions to your achievement in inverted commas, experience everything.
Yeah.
You know, and try and understand everything. Don't sort of try and shelve anything, any of these experiences anywhere, because everything is important to experience.
It is. It is. And we have, it's, you know, the dark and the light, isn't it? We have, if it's everything is positive, then we're not truly living, because we don't know it's positive, because we have no benchmark by which to exactly. judge it. So,
you know, okay, very, very strong sort of blinker appearing that we can't see.
Amazing. And we all want to go through life and kind of create our own dent in the universe, you know, to make some kind of impact and think, well, you know, I've made my time on this planet worthwhile. I've done something with it. And it doesn't have to be huge things. I say, you know, we don't have to be a Mother Teresa to make an impact on the world. Actually, just sometimes walking down the street and smiling at somebody, we don't know what they might be going through, and how that one smile and how that good morning could actually change their whole day.
So, yeah, I mean, the other thing I think, as I've realized more and more as I move forward in life is your own insignificance in this big universe, you know. And I think it's very, very important to realize that, to move, to come out of your own bubble, that, you know, you are not the, you're not what the world is centered around. You know, but I think that that realization also of your insignificance is quite important. Then you also realize that, you know, what you, what even every little thing that, that you do, you know, that it may, as it may be what is probably the biggest thing that you can do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Rabiu, amazingly, we've reached the end of our time. I could go on talking to you for hours. It's absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much. It's been a complete joy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So this has been Katie Day with Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.